everyone else is in the same boat, actually.
Yeah, we're actually working in the registry constituency now and on trying to develop something. Hopefully should have that one soon. And David Ferris is working on something from the BC, right, David?
Yes, that will then go out to the BC for review.
Right. So hopefully we'll have something from them shortly. Registrars, I have not heard anything from Paul, and the ISP, I haven't heard anything from Tony.
Maggie's working on the ISP one, I think.
Maggie?
Yeah.
Okay. So how's everyone else doing?
Good, recovering from last week, and you?
Same. Although I had a pretty good time, David, after,
Paul's still the joint.
Oh, hey, Paul. Good to have you. I was just saying after, I took my grandparents out in the city, in New York City, for a couple days.
Nice.
And, they had a good time. I took them to see a Broadway show, and they loved it.
That's great. I was at the UNICT Task Force meeting on Saturday, so it didn't stop with me Friday afternoon.
Ugh. Well, are they coming out with, I know there was a press release, but are they coming out with an official statement, official report or anything from that meeting? Or?
Yeah, they probably will. There was very little discussion on internet governance because they said they needed to have a clearer sense of where the Secretary General was going with his working group before they could identify what kind of role they could play. But that whatever role they play would probably build upon their expertise of facilitating multi-stakeholder dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
China made its normal intervention that, which I think we've moved beyond, or I hope we've moved beyond, which is that internet governance must be done by an intergovernmental organization. I think that we've moved beyond that discussion and that they're actually standing a bit alone on it now.
Huh. All right.
But other than that, nothing really relevant to...
That's good. Well, we'll see what happens with that working group, right? When is Kofi Annan supposed to start this working group?
Well, Marcus Kummer from the former e-envoy from Switzerland has been named as the head of the secretariat. And so he's going to be working to form that secretariat, and it's supposed to be formed by June or first thing in July.
Do we know if any non-governmental entities will serve on it?
Well, that's what the Declaration and Action Plan requires, and we've been pushing hard that there be equal representation. And that means in the deliberations and the decision-making.
Hmm. All right, well, I don't mean to get us off track, so thanks, David. All right, now we have registrars, we have registry, we have BC, we have ALAC, and we have ICANN. Still no one from the ISPs or non-commercial? All right, well, why don't we get started? There's obviously a lot of work we need to do. We're supposed to have a preliminary statement by April 9th, which is next week. I'm going to talk to Bruce because I'm not sure that that's actually going to happen given that we haven't gotten positions by all of the constituencies yet. And certainly a lot of the data was lacking from the survey responses. I think the only things the survey did was reaffirm the notion that or the questionnaire is that there are people that believe that there are legitimate uses for WHOIS information and that they should have some sort of access to that information, but none really addressed whether it's by what means that access should be derived, whether it's port 43 web-based access. Those were the questionnaires. Now we have three statements from three different constituencies that each have semi-different positions, so we need to talk about reconciling those three, plus the others that should be coming in. So let me just ask for a status report. David Ferris, once you send that to the BC, do you know about how long do you guys need to come out with a statement?
Well, I'm thinking that what I've attempted to do, and I'm going to make it very clear for everyone on this phone, is build upon the existing BC position so that it can basically go through the leadership, I think, to get finalization, since it's not going to be new positions. It might just be a little bit of a different build upon those existing positions. So I think there'll be pretty fast turnaround. But just so you all know, I'm looking at what the BC has said in the past, and it's not necessarily what USCIB would say publicly as an organization.
All right, now, is there anything in the past, and I don't remember, anything that addresses specifically access, like how to get that access, or...?
There is, hold on one second, I mean, it's fairly generic, but what it did say in the past is that we could consider restricted access for legitimate parties if necessary and workable. If the word will be a more useful who is for parties chasing bad faith use of trademark spammers, etc.
Mm-hmm.
So later on we talk about differentiated access schemes, and that it'd be critically important to understand the implications and costs of any such scheme before they're approved and implemented.
Okay.
But that's all very preliminary. The last bit.
Okay. Now, with the registries, and David Maher, are you still on the call?
No.
We're getting a bunch of... We're gathering all the information for our statement, and we'll hopefully have something that we could issue by early next week, I'm hoping. It's just been, there's divergent views in the registry constituency, and we're trying to find some common ground, and I think we've had some good dialogue, at least on email, the last few weeks, but actually writing the position is taking a little bit longer than we thought. And Paul, what about the registrars? How are they doing?
It's not looking good, but I hope to have it this week.
A statement this week?
Yeah, I think it's, I don't know if it's the number of members or what, but hoping to have something this week.
Okay, and now do you guys have to vote on that or anything? Is there...
You know, the other task forces had submitted drafts to the list, and I don't think they're talking about voting, so...
Okay.
I don't know the answer to that, but I think that...
This is Barbara. I was going to suggest that if we can encourage people to get us drafts that look like they are reasonably close to what will be finally submitted, if they could get the drafts to us earlier than the actual voting, that might speed things up a little bit.
Are the registries going to vote?
Yeah, but it's pretty easy for us. You know, there's only 9 of us. So we...
There has not been a talk about voting on the list.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Well, you know, it's hard enough just to get them together to answer questions, you know, the queries and the surveys. And it's hard enough to get them to participate at all in just coming up with policies for the draft. So
I'd actually seen that, you know, your list is obviously public, so I'd seen some of the debate go back and forth as to there was some question whether we were getting away from our mandate, and so...
Yeah, I think I replied to that, and then they replied back, and what's going to happen is I'm just going to write the draft, and then, because I think I know, you know, just from the Rome meeting and talking to registrars off the list and, you know, in person... I think I have a good idea what the registrars want, so I'm just going to write the draft myself and submit it to the list, and what do you think about this? And we'll see what they say.
Okay.
I'm going to try to do that today. So I think, you know, a few days of conversation back and forth on the list, I expect it to die down by this Friday or Monday. So if there is no vote, I would guess I would have it by the end of this week or Monday, at least before the next call. If there is a vote, at least you'll have a draft of what we're voting at by our next call.
Okay, that's good. Hey, Barbara, have you had any, and Glenn, have you had any discussions with Bruce about extending this deadline?
Not yet. There's a council call on Thursday that might be an appropriate time to raise that.
Yeah, I think we're going to need a couple weeks.
And you've been invited, the task force chairs have been invited, Jeff. Have you received the invitation?
Yes, I saw that.
Good.
So, yeah, I think we're going to need a couple weeks. especially because, you know, the other thing I was looking at is in the old bylaws, and I have to look at the new bylaws, but I thought the old bylaws specified we had come up with what needed to be in each report. And I have to look at the new bylaws to see whether there's any of those have carried forward. Because the reports were pretty, the format under the old bylaws was pretty set out. It had to have a bunch of different sections.
Right. I actually am not sure that's in the, if that got carried forward into the, forward into the PDP. My suggestion, Jeff, is actually that you write to the other two task force chairs.
Right.
And see if you guys can collectively come up with a proposal for extending the deadline. That I think is going to get the most, the best reception, if you will.
Right. Okay, I will do that. In the meantime, I thought we would go over the three position statements that we've received so far, see if we can see any common ground. Maybe if the others who haven't submitted statements can just say whether they think that is something that they agree with, don't agree with. Or the other thing is we need to kind of look at the terms of reference and see what format we want to put this in. I think maybe talking about these three statements might help us brainstorm on a good format of the body for the preliminary report. So, and what I did is I kind of just tried to put it all into one document, and I kind of summarized, and Thomas sent a couple of corrections to my summary of the ALAC, and I just did this for myself. I thought it might help. It's not meant to replace the actual position that was submitted, but more just to help kind of pick out the main parts of the recommendations. So going through the IPC first, the IPC supports limiting query volumes on port 43, but they say that any changes, kind of like what David said, you know, they kind of need to look at the cost and everything associated with the solution, and limiting their concept of limiting port 43 access, it cannot or it should not in any way be designed to inadvertently have effects, the detrimental effects on what they call legitimate use of who is. They believe that that legitimate users of who is should have unrestricted, unhampered access to port 43. They don't really go into any way of really how to tell whether one is a legitimate user and one is not a legitimate user. They just basically say that, you know, legitimate users need to have unfettered access to port 43. And one of the other points they say is that a solution must identify realistic volume breakpoints between low volume queries via port 43 that should remain unrestricted and a very high volume of queries that could in principle require an efficient and workable form of disclosure to registrars of the uses to which query results would be put. So there's no one from the IPC here. What I gathered from that statement is that if someone wants to use a high volume, whatever that is, that they would not oppose making that person disclose why they want to get that high volume. But if they want a low volume, that they should, they don't think there should be any barriers or obstacles for someone getting any, whatever low volume of queries via port 43. They also say that port 43 and web-based access should be free of charge, and that any solution must be accompanied by proactive enforcement of the obligation to make bulk access available. Any thoughts on that? Questions? I mean, obviously no one from the IP on here, but if we have any questions, we can kind of submit it to them about that statement.
Go ahead, Wendy.
I guess I will, you know, preview a point that comes up in what ALAC has said, which is that any definition of legitimate has to be as open to the people challenging IP claims or challenging their registration of names as it is to the other side. so that no one is disadvantaged in an investigation or a litigation or a UDRP proceeding by inability to get the same access to who is as the other side has.
So, okay, we could break that down into actually a couple points. Number one is, and I think in going through the ALAC, one of your recommendations is that anyone who asks for this WHOIS information should pretty much be identified. Was that one of the points, or was that non-commercials? I'm trying to remember now.
Well, we've suggested a tiered setup where basic information, basically information that the registrant chose to make available, would be available anonymously, and sensitive information, if required to be collected at all, and the previous part of our statement was none of this information should be required, but if it were, then requesters should be required to identify themselves, and that identity should be available to the registrant whose data was looked up.
So kind of like a WHOIS for the
who's watching
users.
The watchers.
Right.
Except in the case of certain law enforcement, is that correct?
There could be delays in revealing the identities of law enforcement, that's right.
All right. Now, the other things in the ALAC position, Wendy, do you want to go into a little bit? So basically, it's a two-tiered where there would be public access to some set of information that's been hopefully defined in Task Force 2. And that's another weird thing we could recommend in theory, a two-tiered access, but Task Force 2 could come out with there's only one set of data, in which case they would have to be reconciled.
Right. So the core of ALAC's position actually doesn't make it into this discussion, but is that no data should be required from a registrant beyond sort of name server and domain name and the technical information required to make a domain name operational. You could extend that to a technical contact that could be a individual or his delegate, but that the domain name registrant should be permitted to register without giving a name or an address or a telephone number as long as his registrar was able to get the correct payment from him.
So assuming, so I guess going into that a little bit further, your concept is, or the ALAC's concept is that data that you just mentioned would be non-sensitive data. So it would be the name server information, maybe the registrar it's associated with,
yep.
The domain name itself. So there would be a certain set of that data that you are sending in your statement to Task Force 2, that would all be under your Tier 1 public access?
Yes.
Okay, and then all the other, assuming, you know, the other stuff is collected, that would all be under your Tier 2, which should be, you know, if someone wants more complete set of data, they need to identify themselves and the purpose, and then the identity and the purpose needs to be made available to the registrants if they request it.
That's right.
I have a question on that.
Sure.
So they could lie on that, right? So anybody could say, I'm, you know, President Bush or whatever, and I want access. Would the people who, like the registrars of the registry who give out the information, have to make sure that guy is actually, you know, President Bush? That was my first question. Then the second one is, what if they have a reason? Is there a list of acceptable purposes, or is it anything goes?
Well, so the questions go hand in hand because part of the thought is that the identification serves as a check on illegitimate uses. And so, yes, there would have to be some sort of verification of the legitimacy of the identity of the requester, but it seems the registrars are already being forced to do that to verify the identity of the right, this grant in accuracy purposes. This is about reciprocity. If you can get my information, I can get your information. And if this all seems too burdensome, a far easier solution is to say nobody can get anybody's information. That's frankly what I prefer.
I guess one of the differences, and Paul, you can interject, with verifying, and I'm not saying this should be done or shouldn't be done, but the difference is verifying information of registrants can be done a little bit easier because you have a business, the registrar in theory has a business relationship with the registrant. So to the extent you can verify a credit card or something like that and get paid, there's some sort of verification. Now, to the extent how far that gets carried out is another task force. But if someone just requests who is information, you're not getting paid by them. You're not collecting credit card information. So even those limited checks aren't available for someone requesting who is.
Two quick comments.
Maybe that's part of the reason that this whole system needs rethinking.
Yeah, right. Two quick comments. On the one side, the registrant side, a lot of registrars have reseller-type models, so we're not paid directly by the registrant. We're paid by an intermediary, so it's difficult to get, for example, the credit card information for the actual registrant. And then on the other side, it's actually easier because we could say, input your credit card information, we won't bill you, but we're just going to validate who you are. So kind of hard on one side and easier on the other side than what you made out to be just.
Okay. And so, all right, so let me summarize. The ALAC position number one is pretty much no data should be made public, or no sensitive data. Option two is that if sensitive data has to be made available, then it would be made available only through some sort of authenticated access mechanism. Now, would that be the same whether it's port 43, web-based, it's probably easier to do that. I'm not sure if someone can do that on port 43.
I think
something like CRISP or the newer augmented services, I think web-based is the worst of all worlds, but there are clearly protocols that can talk to one another, exchange authentication information and then data in a more automated way than type it into a web form.
Okay.
So I have another question.
Yes, Paul.
Let's say the Tier 2 person is granted access to the full data. Are they then allowed to give that? Would they be able to automatically query the whole database and then store that and give that to other people who aren't authenticated, like act as a proxy for somebody, for example?
Well, they're supposed to both authenticate and give the reason that they're using the data, and presumably reselling to a non-authenticated party wouldn't be a valid reason, and somebody who was found to have done that would be cut off from future access and perhaps punished for breaches of an agreement.
So you'd expect the terms of use, obviously, to accompany, terms and conditions to accompany any kind of access. And that would be prohibited.
To the sensitive layer of data.
And that would be, for example, they might not be able to gather all the information, or there might be limits on how much they could gather in a day in that agreement. Is that right?
There could be, sure.
Okay. Well, let's just go to, just before we continue on, let's go to the next statement, which is the non-commercials, because that's kind of on the other end of the. Oh, I'm sorry. There was one other thing discussed in the ALAC report, and that was on the use of CAPTCHA, which is they're referring to graphical is not the right word, but basically when you go to some websites and you see it tells you to retype a word, and it's kind of mixed in a graphic. And so the question is, right now, there's a lot of debate going on whether that actually works. And there's documented cases where people have found out ways around that. The goal of CAPTCHA was to develop some sort of way that would require human intervention in order to do queries, any type of queries. You know, so for who is, in theory, it would require some person to actually type in a word that they see. And in theory, it was developed because they thought that computers couldn't read those words and couldn't do these automated scripts. Well, apparently, there's documentation that that's no longer the case. While it may have worked, it's kind of like the escalating war. You know, when one side develops a tool, the other side develops, you know, a weapon, the other side develops an even stronger one. And so there's documented evidence that those pictures and those words don't really prevent machines from querying. So ELAC does not recommend going down that path. Is that correct, Wendy?
That's correct, yes. We do not recommend CAPTCHA test or similar Turing test-type technologies.
Okay, and then the last point is a non-commercial, and they kind of take the ultimate fringe, or the ultimate end. Basically, they say that that ICANN needs to recognize the original purpose for which WHOIS data was collected, that they don't believe it's possible to develop any technical mechanism that could restrict port 43 to only a specific purpose. So I guess they don't think it's possible to do tiered access, especially if it's something like, you know, non-marketing uses, which is kind of vague. And they think that any restrictions or access restrictions that we recommend will apply to any user, no matter what the purpose is. So they think that, in addition, leaving, you know, closing port 43 but allowing web-based access would just drive people to develop automated processes for web-based access. And so basically the only thing they say is that they question whether we can achieve anything of any value. I like reading that because, yeah, I hope we can do something of value, but apparently the non-commercials don't think we can. And they say that it's outside of our scope to make any judgments about justifications on for who is information. They think that automated scripts for port 43 are the same thing as getting bulk access, and therefore the same policy for bulk access that we have should apply to port 43 and vice versa. And kind of similar to the ALAC position, they think that really the best way of stopping abuse of port 43 is to limit the data, and that's really Task Force 2. And that they caution that anything that we develop for port 43, let's say we eliminate it or make changes, that that's not any kind of substitute for privacy. With the non-commercial statement, my personal view is, and I think we've heard forever the original purpose for which WHOIS was created. For me personally, I don't find that persuasive anymore, because it's like, you know, the same thing. But the internet was created initially for the military and some educational institutions. Well, we all know what the internet's developed into, and if we had restricted it, the internet, to military educational institutions, obviously we wouldn't be having this problem today. But so it's important to note the original purpose of WHOIS, but beyond noting what the original purpose is, things can always develop and be used for other purposes for which it was developed. So that part of it, personally, yeah, I don't find persuasive. And
can I?
Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah. Sure.
I think you're right and they're right, and I think we should read their statement in part as a warning against being pulled only in one direction from the original purpose. That, as we note, that the WHOIS database use has changed and the use of the internet has changed, we should recognize that much more privacy protection is warranted, as well as recognizing that there may be other places where access to data is needed. And we tend to have been pulled only in the direction of claiming more data is needed by more different people and less to recognizing that there are now more users who need privacy than ever before.
Right. I think that's right. And so now their next you know, and let me just say what I do agree with non-commercials is that changes to Port 43 are not a substitute for privacy protection. I think that's important. I also agree with their point personally of, you know, it's one way to stop abuse, obviously, is to not make the data so attractive to them. And so that's really Task Force 2.
Jeff?
Yes?
David, sorry, I had to step out for a second, and I'm kind of interjecting on something that maybe, I'm not sure if it's appropriate at this time, but isn't the entire point that we need to strike a balance among all of the different concerns and interests, and we can't go completely to one pretty extreme view?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, and one of the things I'm trying to get out of this discussion is to try to see if there's a balance just from us, so I can jot some ideas down for a preliminary report. And obviously we need to wait for the registrars and registries and business constituency and ISTs to come out with their statement, but it just kind of helped me, at least for organizing this, to just spend some time amongst us just talking about what these balances are. But I think ultimately, in the end, you're right. There definitely needs to be a balance.
It's difficult because all of us have, you know, there's a spectrum of views just in our task force, but also it depends on the other two task forces. For example, if on the non-commercial domain name holders statement, if the task force two comes up with hardly any information, then I don't think they would care too much that it's given out.
Oh, I think that's exactly right. And you know what? And that's where I kind of like... I like Wendy and the ALAC's approach of kind of having not necessarily two different tiers of who can access what data, but more two tiers of sensitive versus non-sensitive data. Because I think that's right. I think the more sensitive the data is, the more we need to consider some sort of restrictions. But and also usually goes hand in hand with that. The more sensitive the data is, the more attractive the data is to data miners.
Right. I like her idea of, hey, if you're going to give up my information, you better get guys' information you're giving it up to, the reciprocity thing. If I got that correct, I mean, that seems like a theory behind their statement was, you know, reciprocity. You give up.
Yes, thank you.
I have another question. If we could go back to that.
Yeah, and actually, let me let's go back to that point. And I'd like to hear from David Ferris and some others on the call too on this. The question I have is, and this is what one of the parts of the ALAC statement that kind of as a registry and one who provides a thick registry with a centralized two is. It says that registrars would have to verify the purpose for who is, and I think I think that's where I'm stuck. So I have no problem with collecting ID of who asks for it, but as far as verifying that, that's, and I think, Paul, you probably have the same concern.
It's one of them, but along that same line is, would the person that's getting the who is need to get verified at every registrar for thin registry information, which is, you know, everybody's after .com's database because it's the biggest, the most used. Unfortunately, it's the thin one. So would the people who are the tier 2 authenticated access people, would they need to go to each registrar, or would there be some kind of central authority that they could go to get validated, that then each registrar could go to make sure they're validated?
Well, good questions for an implementation, I think. I don't think we tried to think through all of the details of how this would work, and in the same way that there's a registrar model, a thick and thin registry, I'm not sure at what point it would be best to put sort of authentication of the data requesters and their purposes.
This is David. To follow on that, I think Bevel is going to be in the detail. because we need to make sure that what all the implications will be for both those requesting the information and for the registrants, as well as the costs, because access to data, the data is critically important to many within the ICANN community, and if this process is so complicated or whatever that it hinders their ability to have access for legitimate purposes, then as I said, I think the devil's going to be in the detail.
I agree with that. We have to look at an eye towards the actual implementation, because if we come up with a policy that is perfect and we all agree on in theory, but then in practice it's just impossible to implement or difficult practically, we're screwed again.
That's why I think we need to have a real evaluation of the implications and the costs, because I completely agree that we can't, in a perfect world, it might be fine to make these policy statements, but policy made in a vacuum almost always ends up being bad policy.
Okay, so part of my response to that is that there are serious costs right now in privacy to registrants who are forced to make the sensitive data available to anyone without choices to restrict that. And so I think even if there are some costs to imposing restrictions on access to that data, those are balanced out. And if this is something that other people are interested in, then we'd certainly be happy to have a discussion that gets into more of the details of how it would be implemented or how it might be implemented.
But, again, it's all about balance. And just until we understand what all the costs and implications are, I can't say that the offset of the additional costs might be an equal or balanced against the privacy concerns and the costs that are being, that as you indicate, might be costs as related to privacy issues. So I just think we need more information before we can make that kind of assessment.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
Part of the problem is that we're weighing some sort of incommensurable values, but privacy is not often measured in economic terms, and so it's hard to compare that against the increased financial cost of protecting it.
Jeff, excuse me, can
sure.
I go off the call, and can Barbara perhaps go on taking notes?
Sure.
Thanks. Bye.
Thanks, Gloria. All right, now, I think we're...